I'm very pleased to welcome back to View from the Roundhouse, Professor Martin Drum. Good morning, Martin.
Good morning, Michael.
I don't know whether to be happy, sad, switch totally off or switch totally on this morning. Martin, we've got Jeremy Rockliffe in Tasmania with the approval of the government to try and form a government. We'll perhaps talk about that at some point. We've got independent members of the Commonwealth Parliament, Kate Cheney, for example, coming up with policy ideas. David Pocock, too, in the Senate. I suppose that's what independent MPs do, but perhaps we can talk about that. And
oh, certainly.
Top of all of that, we've got the news this morning that's been coming that Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu wants to have Israel take control of all of Gaza, bucking the advice, as the New York Times puts it, of the Israeli military and warnings that expanding operations could endanger the hostages being held there and kill more Palestinian civilians. Perhaps we'll start with that, Martin. Is Netanyahu completely losing the plot? You've been predicting this, though, for some time.
Yes, I think he is impervious to international criticism. And I've pointed out in the past where I think that finding peace will actually provide difficult questions for Netanyahu. I think he, so he's pushing on, and he's now announced he wants to take over all of Gaza. And it's such a difficult logistical challenge, never mind the humanitarian catastrophe, that his own military figures, senior military figures, appear from reports to be pushing back on this and saying that it's not really feasible. But he's of a mindset to continue this war and he says, eliminate Hamas completely. But, you know, there's been months and months of heavy fighting and heavy casualties and humanitarian catastrophes, and still Hamas is there in one shape or form. I think their military capacity has been degraded, but their movement, they're not just a standard army.
It seems, even at this distance and being as naive as I am about all of these things, incredibly naive of Netanyahu to think that he, even though they've pretty much obliterated, as we've seen from all of the footage lately, the Gaza area, and there's still a couple of million people living there, that he can push them out and somehow it can be rebuilt, and that indefinitely Israel will control it, and somehow the adjacent Muslim countries will all come to the fore to help them out. I mean, is he completely losing the plot, Netanyahu? How does he think that can work?
Well, there's like I said, I think that his own military is pushing back now and talking about how difficult this is. He's becoming increasingly isolated on the world stage. It's difficult to find another country or many countries that now support what he's doing. Our government's getting increasingly critical. We've seen quite an astounding and important steps towards acknowledging a Palestinian state coming from the Australian government over the last couple of weeks. But they've been slowly moving in this direction, but they're not alone. They're following in the footsteps of France and Britain and others. And it's coming back down to the US as their one main backer. And I think we're starting to get signs that Donald Trump is uncomfortable with this. And, you know, the signs on the images and the video coming across our TV screens, etc. So that's the interesting piece. What stance will Trump take, and is he prepared to really put pressure on Netanyahu himself?
There's nobody else, is there? I mean, we are faced with the fact that the US is this absolute economic powerhouse. We've seen how Trump's been using or misusing the tariff power to knock people into line and make America great again and all that. But they've got this incredible military, as he boasted, Trump boasted, after they bombed the bejesus out of the nuclear sites in Iran. So it's down to Trump. Does he want to go down in history, do you think, as the guy who solved the problem? Not only here, and we'll come to Ukraine in a minute, but do you think the US will really try to turn the screws here on Israel?
Well, they're the last one left, pretty much. I mean, pretty much all your other major world powers have already expressed their views on this. And they're the one country with actual leverage, because they still supply Israel with their weapons, and they still defend Israel in major international forums. So it's Donald Trump or bust, really, in terms of external pressure, even domestic pressure to pause the war or to step back within Israel is not proving that effective. There's a lot of people in Israel that are deeply uncomfortable with this war and expressing so publicly. Now, it is a polarized view. There is a full spectrum of views in Israel about this, but there are people expressing concerns, including the families of hostages, that are not sure about this strategy as an effective means of regaining those hostages alive.
Martin, it's interesting too how the communications about these ideas, Netanyahu's use of the media to get what he's thinking out. I can remember back in the days when Brian Burke was the Premier of Western Australia in the early 80s, and he'd go on 6PR talk back of a Monday morning, basically to let Cabinet know what they were going to have to decide when they next met. And here, the way this statement has come out in its current form from Netanyahu is on Fox News in the US. The war cabinet or whatever is about to meet, but he's told them what they're going to decide. It'd be astonishing if they didn't go with him. But why use Fox? I mean, is he flying kites, Netanyahu? Is he trying to find what Trump thinks with a response on social?
It's a very good point, and I think there is a strategy from Netanyahu here, and it's a bit like the Brian Burke strategy you might have talked about there, and that's where you come out and announce things publicly, and you make it very hard for people within your own immediate inner circle to then contradict that later on. It's because you effectively kind of made that decision publicly. So short of toppling you and launching some kind of coup against you and undermining you, they're kind of locked in line beforehand. It is a slightly dangerous strategy because eventually, if enough people are upset with that, they rebel. But for the time being, you're boxing them into a corner. And on Fox News, there is a reason for this. The biggest, strongest group of people that support Netanyahu all the way are right-wing people in the US, Republicans, not just every Republican, but there's certain types of Republicans that are deeply wedded to the Israeli state, and they will remain supportive of Israel's actions, I suspect. And so he's trying to spend some time helping shape the opinions of the Republican base here as a means of shoring up Trump's support.
I can imagine, as sometimes happens in politics, that if things don't work out well on this issue for Netanyahu, he might suddenly find himself no longer Prime Minister.
Well, you are dancing on a tightrope. If you come out publicly and start committing to new positions that you've not ran through your cabinet yet, and then start committing your military to things that they are deeply uncomfortable with, I'm not predicting a coup. That doesn't happen in Israel. But what I think you might get is mass resignations at the highest level. Certainly, if I was serving at that level and you're deeply uncomfortable with strategy and you don't think it's realistic, you probably resign, don't you? That's what you probably do. And if there was a significant number of them, then that's going to look really bad and cast serious questions on his strategy. So it is a high-risk strategy.
Well, Martin, I'm in my mid-70s. I'm finding it's really a busy time of my life trying to keep up getting the Fremantle Shipping News out, doing podcasts with you and others, doing my work on the Centre for Public Integrity, trying to get my golf in, most importantly, and watching the Dockers win. I mean, there's hardly any time to do anything like saving the rest of the world. And I only mention that because Trump's older than me. And I have to say, I admire this man's pluck and his stamina. He's not only going to come in, I'm sure, wearing the Superman cape and solve the problem in Gaza, but then he's going to fly straight on to Ukraine or somewhere in the Middle East to talk to Putin and possibly Zelensky. I mean, is it all nonsense? Are they going to meet? Is it going to be resolved in Ukraine?
It is actually quite an interesting development because the one man who's never really shown a lot of interest in a peace deal in Ukraine is actually Putin. So Trump's been talking about it for a long time. I think he's strong-armed Zelensky into accepting some kind of deal, even if it may not be a good deal for Ukraine. But the one guy's not really expressed any real interest. He's made the occasional noises, but had really high lists of demands that came with that is Putin. And we are hearing talk of some high-level summit between Trump and Putin. And I would think you probably it's a bit awkward for all concerned if there's nothing to announce from a high-level summit. So perhaps there could be something there. Perhaps there could be some kind of deal announced. Usually what happens with these things is that the various teams thrash something out before they meet. So that's, it's a done and dusted deal and they can smile and shake hands or whatever. Interesting though, Zelensky's probably not going to be there. So it'd be a bit humiliating for Zelensky sitting back and watching on the television Trump and Putin come to some kind of agreement on Ukraine.
I suppose that's why Zelensky is saying he thinks the Europeans have to be there as well.
Yeah, I think that was a smart move by Zelensky because if Putin refuses to have him in the conversation, at least if he brings in, the Chancellor of Germany or Macron, from France or Starmer, someone like that, who admittedly have a fair bit of stake in the game as well, and now paying for a lot of the weapons going into Ukraine, Trump's made them. I think that they should be in the conversation as well and help make sure whatever deal that is there provides forms of peace of security for Ukraine, so this doesn't happen again.
Well, Putin thinks he's winning, or he's got the upper hand, and the language he's been using just in the last day or two doesn't give you any confidence that there's going to be any resolution there, which then raises the next question. How does America push this along if they're not going to intervene in some spectacular way in a military sense? And I suppose one hint there is what's happened during the week between President Trump and Prime Minister Modi of India. Their relationship seems to have hit rock bottom, even though they were having a love-in around the time that Trump was elected. The tariffs are going up, all because of India buying Russian oil. It seems to me this could be a significant geopolitical development.
I think that is another interesting element. Every now and then, Trump really does have to throw his weight around because he makes lots of threats. And sooner or later, you have to act because people won't believe you. We talked about Taco Trump before. Trump always chickens out. So he does actually have to do things. And he's threatened sanctions against people that are buying oil off Russia. And he has to actually follow through with that. And India is in the line of fire at the moment. And I suspect that's what this is about. And it's a way of signaling that he's serious to Putin without yet slapping more sanctions directly on Russia right at this point in time. So, and I think that's part of his message would have been, his special envoy going there is you can expect to see more of this. The people that do business with you might get punished if we can't work something out.
Martin, I alluded, I think, to the Center for Public Integrity and the podcasts I do. I did a podcast yesterday with the Chief Minister of the ACT, Andrew Barr, who's the longest-serving Premier slash Chief Minister in the country, who was the last surviving person from the National Cabinet days, that you'll remember, the COVID days. And I was reminded when I was talking to him that he's actually elected as Chief Minister by the House of Assembly. They don't have a governor-type person, administrator, to make the appointment. So after the elections, they all go into their seats in the House of Assembly, and the House of Assembly is called to order, and they vote for who the Chief Minister will be, and the numbers are then illuminated, if you like, and Andrew Barr becomes the Chief Minister. And that, of course, is effectively what's about to happen under the same Hare Clark system that the ACT is with Jeremy Rockliffe in Tasmania. What do you think is going to happen there?
Very interesting situation in Tasmania. A lot of us are glued on this. At least politics nerds are. Sometimes Tasmania doesn't get a lot of attention, being sort of a smaller state. But a super quick recap: 35 seats in the House of Assembly, Legislative Assembly in Tasmania. They have a certain a proportional electorate system, which does lead to minority governments more frequently, and independence gives them a better chance of being elected, etc. And the outcome of that election was that Liberals won 14 seats, Labor 10, Greens 5, and the rest were independents. Now, you can do your maths, me, you and I, Michael. 14 is four short of a majority. 10 is eight short of a majority for Labor. So neither Labor or Liberal are close to a majority at this stage. It's complicated by Liberals having the bigger number of seats, but the Greens actually more likely to support Labor. So, and then you've got independents that have not openly, not enough of them anyway, have openly declared who they're going to support. So anyway, what happens is under this system, under the Tasmanian system, if the numbers are not clear on the floor of the House after an election, the existing premier is invited by the governor to form government. So he was recommissioned as premier. And of course, he and Parliament will commence. But of course, there's the opportunity for someone to push a motion of no confidence in the government to test whether they actually have the support of Parliament. And we're almost certainly going to see that from the Labor leader, who'll test this. And what then happens will be very interesting. So, do enough independents say, well, we'll agree for Jeremy Rockliffe from the Liberal Party to stay on? Or do they support the Labor Party's motion of no confidence? Now, if they do, then the Labor leader may be invited to form government, but he has the same problem. So are they going to back him in? I would say if the independents probably do need to make up their mind who they are going to support one way or another, and that's probably the only path to seeing stable government here. The extra complicating matter, Michael, just to make this extra messy, is the Labor leader has made it clear he doesn't want to form any kind of deal with the Greens to form government. So what happens there? Do they just trust him that, do they just vote for him anyway? Because he's the lesser of two evils if you're a Green? You know what they do in other countries, Michael? They actually have, they've done this a number of times in Germany. The two larger parties form a majority government between them. So, I've never seen this. It could happen. It would be interesting if it did, but I suspect it won't. But we'll all have a popcorn out in 2 weeks when that takes place.
Well, the one issue where the Libs and Labor in Tasmania will get together and form a common government in that sense will be over the football stadium issue, I imagine. Interestingly, there's been the same sort of balance of power in the ACT Parliament for many years, and the Greens have done the supply and confidence agreements with Labor, and it all seems to have gone well. But of course, it depends on what the policy issues are, and the Greens and Labor don't talk, it seems, much anymore in Tasmania.
I think the context there is a bit different. So, in Tasmania, there are major issues upon which the Labor and the Greens disagree. So, I'll give you two. One is logging, which has historically been a big point of difference. Labor's seen, for economic reasons, been more supportive of it, and Greens, of course, opposed to it. And then, when it comes to things like salmon farming and other sustainability issues, they're poles apart as well. Those issues don't really exist in the same way in the ACT. So I think that part, in part, sort of explains that conundrum.
Well, the only things you can catch in, like Burley Griffin, are European carp, I think, Martin.
Very much so. So it has been a very stable government in the ACT, despite having the same system as Tasmania for electing people.
Martin, you and I have been talking for some time, particularly post election results, about the rise and rise, it seems, of independent candidates, the teal type candidates, all these people filling up a crossbench, small groups of Greens included, I think. And we wonder what the role is of those people in the major parties who have a decreasing share of the primary vote, who say, why would you vote for them? They don't have any power. They have no responsibility. Why would you vote for an independent? Well, I'm wondering during the week whether there's some indications why people do. Kate Chaney has come out proposing a raise in the GST and sort of trying to soften the blow in a sense by saying we should give over $3,000 payments to all Australians in the process. And it's immediately attracted all sorts of comment and the like. But I'm fascinated by the role of the independents in sharpening perhaps an economic debate in Australia, something that we know she's interested to do.
One thing that minor parties and independents can do more easily than people in major parties is throw into the mix different new policy ideas. When you're in a major party, of course, the first question would be if you start throwing new policy ideas around is, are you going to implement them? You know, is that part of your platform? Are you committing to these things? It's different when you're a minor party independent. You've got that more freedom to do that. And there have been a number of economists who have talked about raising the GST and finding different means of offsetting the costs for particularly low-income Australians, because the GST is it's not as progressive tax system as income tax is, but it is a very effective and consistent method of taxation. So that's been a discussion point amongst economists for some time. It is a simpler form of taxation sometimes than some of the other proposals that are put on the cards as well. You remember that some of the proposals by Labor in 2019 that they found very difficult to explain. It was an interesting intervention there by Kate Chaney.
I mean, we do expect these matters to get discussed. So that's, I suppose, one might say exactly what you expect of an independent candidate. They're not claiming that that they can push this through, but they're really starting a national debate over something that hasn't quite gone away.
Yeah, look, I think we're seeing it's going to be interesting how far the government goes. You know, what happens at this summit slash roundtable, and what's the response by government? I suspect that it won't be very ambitious. I expect there'll be ideas come forward, but Albanese by nature is a fairly cautious person on economic matters. He's proven as prime minister, sort of a more steady as she goes type leader. Jim Chalmers is making noises about reform. So, you know, does the Treasurer win the day with a few arguments and bring Albanese along with him? Or does Albanese just say, no, we're sticking to our election commitments only? Very interesting to watch that.
Martin, another independent, I mentioned him earlier, David Pocock, who sits in the Senate, was once a good rugby player for Australia and now doing a pretty decent job in stirring people up in the Senate, has been quite unhappy about the Labor Party's government's decision to lift the ban on PwC following the parliamentary inquiry into the way they mismanaged consultancies. The word is that the finance department has rejected a last minute plea from three senators who led the parliamentary inquiry, urging it not to lift the ban on the consultancy firm competing for new government work. I suppose there's a point at which everybody gets forgiven regardless of what they do. What's your take on it?
It's only, I think it was only introduced in April 24, that ban. So you're only talking a bit over a year ago, not talking a long time ago, that this came in. So forgiveness is pretty quick, I'd suggest here. And this was, as we all know, quite the scandal, where PwC were using information they'd got from participating in government work to sell to their clients for commercial gain. And that's quite a serious matter at the time. But I would have thought that ban would have stayed for longer. I mean, it's only a bit over a year ago. And I think that's a good intervention by Pocock and others to raise this issue. And I would have thought that it has to be very good reasoning around this and important guardrails put in place if someone like PwC is back into consultancy work for government.
No doubt that PwC will be pleased that they acted on the advice of their external media advisors and the like, who said, "Oh, well, these things happen from time to time, chaps." Most of them were. Just duck your head, go off and do a bit of gardening, find some other clients, come back in a year or so. Everybody will have forgotten about it, and they'll let you back into the game. Because it very much looks like that, doesn't it?
Yeah, I think that the strategy of these companies is lay low, and the other thing they did is they offloaded a big part of their consultancy business that had been the problem, and then of course what you can do is you can offload that consultancy businesses and you can start up another. So it's a bit like the guy that runs a dodgy company goes bankrupt and then starts up another one, you know.
The Phoenix Company
Exactly right.
comes out of the ashes. Speaking of
Exactly right.
ashes, Martin, and it's in some ways a bad segue, but it's a segue. I just want to take us to Hiroshima. During the week, we had it's hard to believe, the 80th anniversary of the terrible nuclear bomb hitting the city and then Nagasaki. And the Australian government, through our local Fremantle MP Josh Wilson, were represented at the ceremonies in Hiroshima during the week. And I mean, how does one respond? There was a really interesting artistic response in a story in The Guardian during the week, wild swimming and TikTok dances. People somehow trying to convert that into something more positive. I've been wondering whether many people remember it, whether it's something from the past. I saw a quote from a Japanese man to say, "Oh, well, these days people have got bombs that are much bigger than that. So, so what?" In a sense, I mean, is it a fading emblem for the world?
80 years is a long time ago, and there wouldn't be a lot of people around that remember it, of course, being that far ago. It is really important to remember to commemorate these things because, whilst 80 years, a long time ago, the spectre of nuclear weapons has certainly not disappeared and is still with us. I think it was the horror of Hiroshima and Nagasaki that drove subsequent work on nuclear weapon. Treaties, to try and lower the number of nuclear weapons out there, perhaps contributed to uneasy a lot situations in the Cold War where both parties stepped back from the precipice because they didn't want this to happen again. But of course, the further away you get from a tragedy like this, the more likely it is that the lessons of that are forgotten. And I think that's the danger here. 80 years is a long time. If we need any reminder about how horrible war is, or any good look at Gaza, Ukraine, and other places like Sudan, that remind us of that. But the scale of destruction, if nuclear weapons got involved, would be horrific. It seems a little bit strange to me that you're using wild swimming and TikTok dances, but I'm not going to judge other people in a completely different context. And I think there are young people that are looking for. Yeah, they're dealing with that situation in their own way that they know, and that's coming through obviously in so the young people from Hiroshima using TikTok.
Well, just to quote Josh Wilson, MP, who I've just mentioned, he represented the Australian government at the Hiroshima Peace Memorial in the city. And he said, and this is the point really, isn't it? "It is a solemn reminder of the foundational value of peace and the necessity and the imperative of the cause of nuclear non-proliferation and disarmament." I guess it's like trying to eradicate poverty. Anything else that we'd like not to exist, this will be with us probably forever, Martin.
Probably the one positive, if you can call it that, to that horrible tragedy is that since 1945, there has not been actual use of nuclear weapons in that 80-year period since that time. So it probably did achieve something in that respect, at least.
Well, Martin, we've covered a lot today. No doubt there'll be a lot to talk about next Friday and view from the Roundhouse. But for today, thank you, not just on my behalf, but the many listeners to this podcast who let me know that they value what you have to say and look forward to listening to the view from the Roundhouse of each week. So thank you once again for joining me today.
It's a pleasure, Michael.